That brings us to our speaker. His name's Deshu from Maryland. Please help me welcome Deshu.
Hi. My name is Deshu Gulati, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here and definitely grateful to be sober tonight. Thank you very much for having me. I've been brought up in Alcoholics Anonymous as one of those people that it's an honor to be able to do anything in AA. And I believe it's the greatest honor when somebody asks me to share my experience, because I really think that what we really have here is our experience, right? It doesn't matter about our jobs, our money, our wives, our families, any of that stuff. What I have is my experience to share with another alcoholic, like it talks about in the book, sharing a message of depth and weight. So when I get asked to do this, it really means a lot to me. So I thank you very much for it. This is awesome. this is cool. I've never actually spoken at an outdoor meeting before, so this is kind of cool. And I feel like it's like down where I live, we have concerts where there's pavilion seats and then there's the lawn. You know, it's like, so I feel like I'm a rock star. It's kind of cool. My sobriety date is October 17th of 2002. I have a sponsor and I have a home group. And I didn't know what those things meant when I got here. I had no idea how important they were. And today I know they're really the foundation upon which my recovery is built. I have a sponsor who guides me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and gives me an objective view of my life. I'm right here. Every decision I made, and he gives me that 30,000 foot view. And when, you know, by the time the hour's over, you'll understand why I need a sponsor. I have a home group where I'm accountable. Every Sunday night, I'm there, unless there's another service commitment that I'm asked to do. And it's a place where I am accountable, and people know me. I can go in there, and people ask me how I'm doing, and if I'm lying, and I say I'm okay, they call me on it. You know, and that's important. And it's a safe place for me to go. And my sobriety date is the day where I look at everything, where everything changed. My life, 180 degree difference, you know, from that life of misery, chaos, pain, and for me and the people that care about me, to, you know, what it promises in the book now, happy, joyous, and free. And it's awesome, you know, and it's the day I can look back and when everything changed. If you get nothing else out of my talk tonight, I hope you get that you realize that I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's the most amazing thing on the planet. I have seen it do amazing things to people, for people and for people's families, for the people I care about, and I believe it's divinely given. I don't believe that we're special in any way, and I don't believe that God looks at us that way, but I do believe that we're blessed in the fact that we get to live two different lives in the same lifetime. We get to live that life of misery and chaos and then the one of happiness and freedom. So I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I think people get up here and they say it a lot, and I don't know if they mean to get it confused, but I think people do. And there's the it. It was drinking, right? The it was, and we all have that. We all have the it was fun. It was fun with problems, and then it was usually just problems, and that's what we ended up here. I don't know many people that walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous going, "Hallelujah, I made it," you know, and I sure as hell didn't, you know, I really didn't. But alcoholism affected my life from a really young age. I woke up one morning, we were living in Minnesota, and I heard my mom crying, and it was early in the morning, and I walked out to the kitchen, and I saw two police officers and my mom crying, and I asked her what was wrong, and she said, "Daddy's dead." And my dad was an alcoholic. He had committed suicide. He had stopped a car and jumped off a bridge that night. Now, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. It doesn't make me an alcoholic at all. Shortly thereafter, we moved to... We moved to Maryland, where I grew up. And just to tell you, my dad was in and out of the program. I have 12 and 12 of his with some phone numbers in the back, 24-hour day book. I have some of his chips. He just never got it. You know, he didn't get it. So we moved to Maryland, and I grew up there. And I'll tell you, you hear about a lot from the podium about people feeling different. You know, feeling different from their fellows. And I'll tell you, I ended up in a upper middle class white community where everybody had two parents and nice clothes and stuff like that, and you know, I'm a short fat Indian kid with a single parent, and you're looking at my fourth grade picture and it's like there's everybody and me, you know, and it wasn't hard to figure out where Waldo was. He was right there in front of you, you know, and I was wearing, my mom did the best she could, you know, but I was wearing like stuff from Sears and Kmart, and everybody else was wearing like Izods and polos, and it was just, I mean, I literally was different, you know. People talk about the feeling of different. I was different. But that doesn't make me an alcoholic either, you know. That doesn't at all. I took my first drink when I was 15 years old, and And really, at the time, I didn't think it was a big deal. We were walking home from high school, and we found a beer bottle in a park. It was me and a couple other guys. And they picked it up, and they popped it open, and they took a sip, and they said, here, have some. I never wanted to drink or thought about drinking at that point in my life, never really considered it. But what happened right there when they said, here, have this, my mind said to me, if I don't, they won't like me, and they won't accept me. So I took the sip. Now, I took the sip and spit it out, because it was warm beer we found in a park. It was really gross. And but what I did, what happened is, and this is what I believe makes me an alcoholic, I thought about drinking for the next 2 weeks. And then I ended up at a keg party, and I remember having the cup, the red cup, and I went to the keg, and I remember drinking, and then I don't remember anything about that night. But I remember waking up the next day and wanting to drink, and for the next 17 years I did. Now that, I believe, makes me an alcoholic. It talks about it in the doctor's opinion of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. I have that obsession of the mind, the phenomenon of craving. And that's what I got that day, I believe. And that's what makes me an alcoholic. You know, that's for me personally. And that's why I'm here. You know, once I read that and I thought about it and I knew, you know, I really knew that that's what I mean. Because anytime I drank, I didn't know when I was going to stop. I always wanted more. And I always thought about it, and I obsessed about it, and for 17 years, alcohol ruled my life. You know, it took me places that I never thought I'd go to do things I never thought I'd do with people I was never raised to do them with. But it didn't matter, because I would have sold out anything for alcohol. I grew up in the 80s, and I will vow that contributed to my alcoholism. it was a horrible time in my life. I was in high school in the 80s, and I wasn't the most suave, cool kid in the world. I had a hairdo that was like bangs that came down to my nose. I had a rat tail that came down the side. I wore thin black leather ties, and I wore blazers to school. I wore peg legs with the white socks and black shoes. And if you ever seen the movie 16 Candles, the kid Ducky, that was me. And it was horrible. And what I was really going for was this cross between Don Johnson and Billy Idol. And I missed terribly. And so, I mean, I was feeling awkward. I felt out of place. I had, you know, it was miserable. I don't know how better to describe it. So what I did was I obviously didn't fit in. So I started running around with some of my mom's friends' kids. They were a bunch of Indian kids that, you know, I had something in common with at least. But I still didn't feel right. But what I did was I was the kid that made the fake IDs. And I hung out with the one Indian kid who did drugs, so we had this bad reputation. And it was cool. I liked the bad reputation. You know, everybody thought. And we would go buy the alcohol, and I would buy the beer and liquor for the guys, and we'd buy the wine coolers for the girls, and everything was great. And alcohol made me feel like, you know, drinking and being able to do that and having the reputation made me feel like I was somebody. Because for as long as I could remember, I'll tell you that I didn't like to be me. I always wanted to be taller, skinnier, whiter, more athletic, you know, anything besides what I saw in the mirror. You know, and when I drank, I could be that. And as I continued to drink and as I got older, what alcohol did for me is it leveled the playing field. Because I always compared to what you look like and what you had to the way I felt, you know. And when I drank, all that went away. I could look you in the eye and be okay with who I was because I wasn't really being, you know, I wasn't thinking about who I was. I was somebody else. And you know, an instance of what alcohol kind of did for me is we were going on, when I was graduating high school, my mom gave me a trip. There was a senior trip, and she paid for it, and we were going to go to Rio. And I was super excited, and I was ready to go, and it was great. And then I saw the list of who was going. And it turned out to be all the jocks who had picked on me for 3.5 years. And, you know, and we were, it was like them against us and blah, 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 and all that stuff and all that high school stuff. And I was terrified. I mean, I was literally going to be in a foreign country for 10 days with, like, little or no adult supervision, and I was going to get hammered. You know, I was going to get pummeled by these guys. And I didn't want to go, and I couldn't get my money back. And so we got on the plane, and I sat right in between two of these football players. Like, I knew these guys from junior high, but we got to high school and everything changed, right? You know how it goes. And so we take off, and the stewardess comes by and asks us if we want anything to drink. So we start ordering little airplane bottles, like International Air, whatever it was, we were able to drink. You know, they didn't card us, they didn't care. And we got drunk that night, and then for the next 10 days, we were like best friends. And alcohol did that. You know, we were literally in Rio de Janeiro walking down the streets singing show tunes. You know, we were singing Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch and all that stuff. And we were like this, you know. And this is what alcohol did, because I couldn't do this for 4 years. These guys wouldn't talk to me, and they picked on me, and we were fighting. You know, they were them, and I was with my group, and it would never have ever happened if it wasn't for alcohol, right? And we go, and I come back from high school. We come back, and Monday morning, I'm pulling into the parking lot. And I'm going to go to my side, which the losers hang out, right? And they go like this, and they wave me over. And at that moment, I had arrived. Alcohol had gotten me right where I wanted to be. And my friend talks about it all the time. He talks about those pinnacle moments in your drinking where absolutely everything lines up perfectly, and it's just absolutely perfect. And that was one of those moments, because alcohol had gotten me where I wanted to go my whole life, you know, and to be with the people that I always wanted to be with. And it was there. And it was short-lived, like most of those pinnacle moments, but I chased them for the rest of my drinking, you know, because when it's like hitting a good golf shot, right? If you hit that good golf shot, you're playing golf forever, right? And it's like that. You've one good shot, I can do this, you know, and it's that one pinnacle moment, that one moment where everything's great, and it doesn't matter about every other night of puking over the toilet or coming home late or lying to your girlfriend or, you know, disappointing your mom or any of that stuff, because that moment was still there and it's still out there and you could achieve it, you know? And I chased them all the time. So shortly thereafter, I graduated, and I went to the University of Maryland, and I was a small fish in a big pond. It's 35,000 students. I was awkward. I didn't know what to do. I didn't live on campus. I didn't have a lot of friends, and so I continued to hang out with some of these Indian kids that hung out and lived at home. And what happened was, my drinking started to take off. You know, I didn't have any time limits. I didn't have any place to be. You know, I started not going to school, even though I was paying for it. And these kids started to not like me. You know, I started to become a person that I really didn't know. You know, I was lying a lot more. I was cheating a lot more. I cheated in school. I cheated on girlfriends. I cheated with your girlfriend. I mean, it was. I did a lot of stuff that I wasn't raised to do. So those people got tired of me pretty quickly. So I didn't know what to do. I was feeling, you know, alone, and I was thinking about it, the best alcoholic thinking came up was join a fraternity. you pay them and they have to be your friend. So it worked for me, you know. It was so I did, and plus you get to drink a lot, right? So I start pledging a fraternity, and you know, I mean, my idea of living at that point was what I saw in the movie Animal House. Really, you know, I was joining a fraternity. I'm a young adult and I'm carefree, and you know, I got a job and I go to work and all this stuff, and let's have fun, you know, and that's all it was about. I'm pledging this fraternity, and you know, people, I became the person that people would call when they wanted to go out. You know, it didn't matter if I had school the next day, it didn't matter if I had work the next day, it didn't matter if I had to go see my mom or my sister or any of that stuff. It didn't matter. It was, if they called, I went. And most of the time it was because I didn't want to miss anything. You know, I didn't want to miss anything, and I swore up and down that if I didn't go one night that I would miss something. And the other thing is, honestly, I was terrified that people wouldn't accept me. If they asked me the one time and I said no, they weren't going to ask me again. You know, I drank for two reasons, really. I drank for acceptance and I drank for effect. I absolutely love the effect produced by alcohol for me. You know, it makes me feel wonderful, you know. And I love everything about alcohol. I love the taste of most alcohols. I love the glasses, you know. I love the going to the dive bars. I love going to the big lounges with jazz. And I mean, I loved everything about it, you know. And it made me who I was, really. I felt like, you know, I could dress up and wear a suit and tie and go to this place and drink, you know, scotch on the rocks, or I could go drive my motorcycle and wear my motorcycle boots and my gear and go down to the dive bar and then drink beers all night. And it didn't matter because I could fit in anywhere, you know. And I was happy with it. So I'm pledging this fraternity one night. And I'm coming home from a party we had, and I drove drunk, and I do that a lot, you know, and I'm not proud of it, and it's not something I joke about, because I've come to realize that there are people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that driving drunk isn't funny. They've been affected adversely by people drinking and driving. So I don't I don't know if God was looking out for me or whatever. I'm not sure if that's the case. I just feel very lucky that I never hurt anybody in my drinking and driving. But I drove home that night, and I got home, and it's about 1 o'clock in the morning, and my mom called, and she wasn't feeling well. She wanted me to come home, and I told her I couldn't. I wasn't feeling good, and, you know, I was drinking. And so I told her I'd come home in the morning when I could. She called back a couple hours later and said she was throwing up. And I said I couldn't, you know, I can't come. I can't do anything. A couple hours later, she calls, and she's like, she's really sick, and she needs me to come home. And at this point, I could barely lift my head off the pillow. You know, it was like I was just slurring my words, and I was like an alcoholic coma. It was just like mumbling. And the next call I got was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and my mom was, it was my uncle. And my mom was in the hospital. She had had a heart attack. I didn't show up in the hospital until about 1 o'clock that afternoon. I didn't look good, and I didn't smell good. I didn't feel good. And I had to walk through the emergency room and see my mom, well, my extended family. And the big book talks about a feeling of incomprehensible demoralization. I will tell you that that is a feeling that I know to my innermost core. It's not something I'm proud of, but I know it intimately. And it's that feeling when people look at you and they go, how could you? Why did you? You did it again? You promised. And you look in their eyes and there's that, you can just see the despair and disappointment. And it just cuts through you, you know? And that was a feeling that I had that day. My mom was in the hospital for, you know, a couple weeks and stuff, and I only went to see her a couple times. Now, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I believed at this point, the delusion that I had sold myself, was the reason I didn't go, was because I was so upset and so scared that I'd have to raise my sister alone and my mom would die, and I couldn't handle seeing her in the tubes, with the tubes and all this stuff. And I honestly believed that when I got here. I honestly, deeply believed that was the reason I didn't go. Through the process of working the steps and talking to a sponsor and doing some stuff, and I've come to find out that the reason I really didn't go was because I was worried that I wasn't going to join. They weren't going to let me in the fraternity if I missed anything. It was more important for me to be at those fraternity functions and try to get in that fraternity at that point than it was to be there for my family. And for me, that's what my alcoholism does to me. I use this analogy all the time. We're all God's kids. I believe that, and I believe we're all good people. I don't personally believe that anybody's born innately evil. I think that we all know the difference between right and wrong, or we're brought up knowing the difference between right and wrong. With my alcoholism, it's like when you take a pencil and draw a line on a piece of paper. If you start to erase that line, it starts to smudge. It doesn't completely go away, right? There's always that faint line on that piece of paper, and you erase it some more and erase it some more, and it looks like it's completely gone, but if you look hard enough, that there's a faint resemblance of that line. For me, that's what happens. That's that line between right and wrong and good and bad. When my alcoholism takes hold, that line starts to smudge. It starts to smudge a little bit more, and it gets fainter and fainter, and then eventually what happens is that right now becomes wrong, you know? And wrong is right. And I'm doing things, and I'm hanging out with people that are doing the exact same thing I'm doing. They're acting the same way I'm acting, so how could I be doing something wrong? And the alcoholic life, like it talks about in the book, is the only one I know. And I'm doing things with people that I care about the most, and hurting the people that I love the most. And it's all so I can feel good because I'm a selfish, self-centered alcoholic. My mom got better, and I ended up getting kicked out of school because I didn't go to class. And I did what any good alcoholic would do. I still paid my fraternity dues while I wasn't in college so I could go to the parties. It made sense at the time. So, you know, I continued to do this, and then, you know, I started following the Grateful Dead, and I grew my hair long, and, you know, I did the whole bunch of the chameleon stuff. I had long hair, so if I went to clubs in D.C., I put on a coat and a, you know, silk shirt, and I put it back in a ponytail like Fabio, and then if I went out with my fraternity brothers, I wore my baseball hat backwards, you know, and let my hair down, and then if I went out with my hippie friends and went to the show, I wore tie-dyes Birkenstocks and let my hair, you know what I mean? Whatever it was, nobody had to know who I was, nobody had to know how bad I was, and I could just do what I wanted to do, and that's the way I lived my life. After I graduated college, I ended up, a lot of my friends left, and I felt alone again. They all moved out to Colorado and California and started doing stuff, and I was here. So I moved down to restaurant bar area down in D.C. called Adams Morgan. And basically, two roads come to a T, and on both sides of the T, on both sides of the street, it's lined with bars and restaurants. And I was excited. You know, I felt like I was growing up, and I was being mature, and I was excited, and I thought my greatest alcoholic aspiration at the time was to be able to walk into a bar, order the usual, and have the bartender know what I meant. And that's what I wanted. That's all I wanted out of my life at that time. And I got it. You know, I did. I ended up getting it at 3 or 4 different places. And just to go back for a second, while I was in college and following the Grateful Dead, I started a business. Business that the government frowns upon. Selling, you know, whatever. I was a drug dealer. So I carried that on to moving into D.C. And what happened there was I started to be Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I ended up, after a couple years, I ended up getting a pretty good job in an international organization downtown. What I would do is I would go to work during the day wearing a suit and tie. I'd come home at night, change my clothes, and I'd go to the club. And I would sell drugs. And it was great. You know, I thought it was awesome for the time. Really what was happening was the times where I was in D.C. and I was working, and before I got this really good job, I used to work at a cubicle. I would go to work, and I would stay up all night, pretty much. I would drink until like 3 or 4 in the morning. I would do other things to help me stay awake, and I would lay down about 6:30, and I would get up and try to go to work at like 8:30. I would go in, and the days where when I was working, when I had a cubicle, when I was feeling tired, I would actually go into the bathroom stall, and I would sit on the toilet and kind of nap. I wouldn't have told you anything was wrong. I was just tired. You know, I didn't think alcohol was an issue. But then, as I started to grow older, or I got another job, I used to have a desk. I used to have an office, and I used to be able to go in the morning, and I would have to do something from like 9 to 10. There was something I had to do every day. And I would do it, and then I would shut my door, and I would sleep under my desk. Again, I was just tired. You know, I never thought it was an issue. I honestly, during this whole time, I never would have told you that alcohol or any of me staying up late or drinking all night was a problem. Because the people, I was doing it with people that were still doing it. You know, I was hanging out with people that were doing the same thing. After a few years of this, it started to get old for me, and I really didn't know any. I thought my life was just going to be this way. I will tell you that I woke up a lot with those feelings of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair all the time. I didn't know there was a way out. I didn't know that I could feel any better than I was feeling. I just thought this was my life, and this was the hand that was dealt, and you know, my life was going to be miserable. You know, and it was a miserable existence for me. It was the same thing over and over every day. I went to work one day. It was March 28th of 2001. Again, I woke up with that feeling, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, going, God, another day, you know, another one. I honestly believe that alcohol kept me alive long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to commit suicide because of what my dad did, you know, and I couldn't put my mom through that again. You know, but I didn't want to live. It was just sucked. It sucked to have to wake up every day. And what I did was I went to work that day, and I got there, and they got a call from security, and they wanted me to come down, and they wanted me to pick up a FedEx package. Now, I've been working at this place for almost 5 years. It's an 8,000-person organization. Security, one, doesn't get FedEx packages. Two, I'm a web guy. I did web work for them, internet work, and I never got a FedEx package, so I kind of had a feeling that something was wrong. So much so that on the way down to the main building, I stopped to buy a pack of cigarettes, smoked two, and when I got to the front door of the headquarters building, the DEA arrested me, and I got charged with conspiracy to distribute MDMA, commonly known as ecstasy, and I was facing a lot of federal jail time. And at that very moment, I can tell you that I wanted to be dead and I couldn't die. There was nothing to do. And then I had to go home, and I had to eventually tell my mom that her son was a drug dealer. And again, incomprehensible demoralization. You know, how do you tell your mom? How do you tell her that her son, you know, is doing these kind of things and has become this person? And for the next year and a half, we fought that case. I fought it, you know, and it got postponed, and we fought it. And during this time, my sister, who's an amazing woman, an absolutely amazing woman, brilliant. She's a lawyer, beautiful, fantastic, fantastic, kind-hearted woman. And she was planning on getting married. Let me go back for a second. When I lived in Adams Morgan in D.C., she went to the George Washington University, which is approximately 15 to 18 blocks from where I live. We got into an argument one night, and she told me that her friends didn't believe that she had a big brother because she talked about me all the time but never saw me in 3 years. She lived 18 blocks from where I lived. She would come to Adams Morgan where I lived and not even tell me that she was in my neighborhood. Because of that, I wouldn't have gone to see her anyway. She planned a surprise birthday party for me at a restaurant a block from my house, and I showed up an hour and a half late because I was going out and I was dealing drugs. This is what I was doing. I didn't treat them well. During that time, I was fighting that case. She was supposed to get married. And in my culture, my dad was gone, and I had a role. I would have to have a role in the wedding. But there was going to be no way to explain the fact that I wasn't there if I had gone to jail. So as we were fighting this case, and I kept getting the court dates postponed, she was postponing her wedding and lying to her fiancé. This is what I do, because it was all, you know, this is what I do to the people I care about. And this is what they end up trying to do to cover for me. She screamed at me and she got mad at me one night, telling me that I was the most selfish person that she's ever met in the entire world. And I just screamed back at her with a plethora of curse words and you know, slammed the door. And that was our relationship. So I fought that case until 18 months. And on October 17th, I ended up having to plead guilty. And I had to go to prison. Now I'll tell you, I prayed when I was fighting that case. I got on my knees and I prayed. Now I will tell you this though, I wanted absolutely nothing to do with God. I actually had a very tenuous relationship with God. I watched my mom pray every day of her life, every day. Both her parents died when she was little. She raised two of her sisters who both died. She had two nephews that she raised, both of whom have died. Her husband committed suicide, and her mother-in-law died of lung cancer, never smoked or drank a day in her life. I ended up going to prison. My mom has a list of health conditions as long as my arm, including congestive heart failure, anemia, glaucoma, rheumatoid arthritis. She's had renal failure. I wanted no part of a God that gave that in return for prayer. That's what I saw. And that's what I believe. So if that's where prayer gets you, who the hell wants any of that? My relationship with God was like, you can knock me down, you can make me as miserable as you want, I'm going to get myself up, I'll flip you off, and I'm going to say, bring it on, because you're not going to make me quit like my dad. And that was my relationship with God. And then when I prayed before I had to plead guilty, obviously God didn't work again. Right? I'm going to prison, so he didn't work. And prayer doesn't work. And that was what I thought. And that's what I believed when I got here. So, on October 17th of 2002, I ended up turning myself into the federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. And I got there, and my ego was pretty big still, even though I was terrified. I figured they were going to look at my folder and my file and see that I was college educated and had a really good job and treat me special. I am here, and I can assure you that when you go to prison, as a federally convicted drug dealer, they treat you like a federally convicted drug dealer. I was treated just the same as every other drug dealer that was in the place. I wasn't special. I got there, they shaved my head. I was a boot camp program, and military-style boot camp prison, and they shaved my head, gave me army green, some combat boots, and we went at it. And it was waking up at 5 a.m. every morning and doing physical labor, or physical exercise, marching, some hard labor, some class, some marching, physical exercise, and you get the picture. It was like that until about 10 o'clock at night. So what happened there was We had to march every night after we ate, right? So it was about an hour and a half to 2 hours of marching. But I started to see on Thursday and Friday nights there were people sitting down in this classroom while we were outside marching. So I asked what was going on. So on, you're getting the picture. Friday night, it turned out that you could sit down if you went to the AA meeting. You'd go to the AA meeting, right? Guess what this guy did? I volunteered for AA. That's what got me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. So I went there, and actually what happened on Thursday night is I volunteered for Al-Anon too, because I got to sit down for an hour. So I like Al-Anon a little bit. But what happened there was an elderly lady and an elderly man who had to walk around with an oxygen tank came into this federal penitentiary every other Friday night and brought us out an AA meeting. Now, I'll tell you, everybody in that room was there to get over like I was. We weren't really interested in not drinking or what they had to say or any of that stuff. But what happened was I started to listen to her. And I started to listen to what was going on, and she would talk. And none of us, it was during the war. Okay, at this boot camp program, let me tell you, we only got one 15-minute phone call a week. We had no radio, no television, no newspaper. We had, and visitors were, you know, on Sundays, but, you know, most of us were 4 or 5 hours at closest from where we lived. So nobody was getting very much information, so we would talk to her. I know now what her bringing that meeting in to us did for her, but I know what it did for me. I will tell you that I am lucky enough, and I have the honor of chairing our area intergroup association down in D.C. I have sat in meetings of our H&I committee and listened to people 6'4", 6'2", 6'3", whatever, you know, young men complain about being afraid of going into a juvenile detention center for their own, fearing their safety. Now, that's okay. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with what they're doing or if they have those fears. But what I will tell you, if it wasn't for that elderly lady and that elderly woman who came into a federal penitentiary without fear and knowing that they were doing the right thing and carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing that God was with them, I wouldn't be here today. So I'm forever indebted to them, and I take my service work very seriously and carrying the message to alcoholics very seriously, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for people like that. But she would talk, and I asked her one day, what makes you an alcoholic? Because I got curious, you know. I sat and listened to her for a while, and she said, well, what do you do when you get envious? What do you do when you get jealous? What do you do when you get angry? What do you do? She goes, you slowly go out and commit suicide while that other person is even thinking about you. I said, huh? But, you know, it's true. Somebody would make me angry. I drank at people. Basically, that's what she's talking about, the resentment and drinking at people. I drank at my mom, my dad, my boss, my girlfriend. Screw you, watch this. I'm going to go out. And I would go out, and they're off doing whatever they want to do. Well, I'm going out, and I'm drinking, and I'm killing myself, you know? And it talks about it clearly in the 12 and 12, in the fourth step of the 12 and 12. It says, beating ourselves up with a club of anger intended for somebody else. That is exactly how I live my life. So I wrote my mom a letter that night, and I told her I don't think I'm ever going to drink again. And I had met this man who I believe God put in my life at that point. And he had a Bible. And we started talking about what was in his Bible and what was in this book that my mom gave me, this book on Hinduism. And we weren't allowed to bring anything in except one religious book into this prison. But what I found out was what his book said and what my book said were saying the same sort of thing. They were just saying it in different ways. And then I started to realize that maybe there was something up there. There was something there. There was a God. There was some sort of higher power that was... It was the same for everybody. You know, it wasn't about religion. It wasn't about religious doctrine. It was about something bigger than us. So I ended up starting to pray that night. And I took the Serenity Prayer and I changed it to God grant me the courage to change my life, the strength to do it, and the wisdom to know it's the right thing to do. And I prayed that prayer every night. And I started praying for my mom, and I started praying for a friend of mine who was back in Maryland, and she was getting a divorce, and I just started to pray. And I don't know why. I don't know why it was okay for me to start believing it then, but I did it. And I was sitting in a meeting about 6 months ago, and I'll tell you, I started thinking about that, and I realized that it was the first prayer that I can remember ever being answered, because I was sitting in that meeting, and I'm sober. I'm standing here and I'm sober, and that was kind of cool. It was kind of really cool. I got out of that federal penitentiary, and I ended up at a halfway house type place in Maryland, and it was close to my house, and they told me I had to go to 3 AA meetings a week. I said, no, I'm an alcoholic, I admit it, I know, we got it, I'm going to go to one, and it's okay. And they said, no, you're going to go to three, you're going to go back to prison. I said, okay, I'll go to three. Again, alcoholic, not stupid. And so I started going to these meetings, and I'll tell you, you know, I had to bring that guilt and shame about the things I did with my mom and my sister in Alcoholics Anonymous, but then I also brought a lot of ego and judgment with me, too. I would go to these meetings, and I would listen to people share, and they were talking about going to, you know, they had to go to jail sober. They were living their cars sober and all this stuff, and I'm walking back. Now, mind you, I'm still property of the federal government. Property of, right? Property of the federal government. And I'm walking back to a place where they're going to tell me when I can eat, when I can sleep, when I can go to the bathroom, and I have to piss in a cup to make sure that I'm even allowed back in. And I'm judging the people that are going home from the AA meeting that night. And that's the kind of person that I am, you know. I was going to these meetings, and I wanted to drink for the first time. Because you people were out, they were alcoholic. I wasn't. That was just crazy. My life wasn't that bad. Right? I'm in a halfway house, and my life wasn't that bad. And, so what happened was I ended up getting in touch with a friend of mine who I had drank with through a series of events. I started a business when I had to leave that organization. I had to leave when I fought that case. I started a business because I figured I was never going to be able to work for anybody again. So a friend of mine and I had started a business, and I went away and I came back and I was working there, and it turned out that he had seen a friend that we used to drink with, and he had gotten sober, and he had told him what was going on with me, and he asked, so he told me to call him, and I called him, and I asked him to temporarily sponsor me, and not because I wanted a sponsor, but because I wanted a home pass. And he yelled at me. He said, "You're not getting over anymore." I said, "Excuse me? Well, this is a dude I drank with, right?" So, he told me where to go to meetings, and he told me to go to some of these meetings, and I went. And what happened was, I went to meetings that are like this, that are like this one, where you walk in and there's an energy, and you can feel it. And it's not people that are sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous. They're not here because they have to be. They're here because they want to be, and they're doing the deal. And my sponsor talks about it all the time. There's an atmosphere of recovery, you know, and there's that energy in the room, and there's a presence of God, and there's just recovery, and you can feel it, and it's palatable. And that's what was going on there. There were greeters, and there were people that were happy, and they were going to the beach, and they were doing all these things. And I was excited, you know. I was like, wow, something could be different. So I ended up going to these meetings, and I ended up getting an ankle bracelet, and I ended up in my own house now. I'm out of the halfway house, and I'm at this place, and it turns out, like, I should be excited. It should be the best day of my life, right? I'm home. And it was the loneliest day of my life. I had nobody to talk to. You find out who your friends are when you go to prison. And all I had were numbers of these people from Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started to call them, and I started to do a little bit. I got my ankle bracelet off right around the time I celebrated my first year, and I was praying, and I wasn't really happy, and there's a couple reasons. One was because I wasn't doing anything, and the other one was because I brought an ex-girlfriend in the program. Thought she was going to get sober, I was going to get sober, and we'd live happily ever after. She found a dude with 30 days, and she was happily ever after with him. And now she's married and has a kid with him. And I'm happy for him. But that was part of it. And then the other reason was I was on my knees, and I was praying, and I was miserable. I was crying, and I was on my knees praying because people told me to, and nothing. I wasn't feeling good. And I went to an AA dance. And it sucked, and I left, and I called my sponsor that night, and I said, "I'm done, I'm out," and he said that I had no faith, and I said, "What are you talking about? I found God in prison," and like I had some spiritual master that, you know, got it all in a couple months, but what he was talking about was that I had no faith that what you were doing in Alcoholics Anonymous was going to work for me, because I wasn't doing anything, because I had had the ankle bracelet on. I had 15 minutes before the meeting to get there. I get there 15 minutes early, I could stay for the meeting, and I had to leave 15 minutes after. Otherwise, sirens were going off in my house, and police would come and all that stuff, so I got home on time. So I said, okay, you know what? I made a decision that day, and I got three service positions in 10 days. I started dropping people all over the place. I picked up, I mean, down in my area, I don't know if you've heard, but it's the first or second worst traffic in the country. And I was driving 45 minutes one direction, an hour the other direction, 15, 20 minutes another direction, and then down into D.C., around the suburbs, and then down into D.C. to pick up people and take them to the meeting, you know, and I would do this after work during rush hour. And what would happen was I would go, and I'd have the meeting before the meeting, I'd have the meeting, and I'd have the meeting after the meeting. And I love crazy new people. Love them, right? I mean, if you need to get out of yourself, crazy new guy is the best thing to talk to. And but what I was lucky with, and I believe I was very lucky, is that I ended up becoming friends. My friends were my sponsor's friends, and they were some dudes, some guys with time. And they were listening to me, and they really, when it was time to tell me to shut up, they told me to shut up. And when it was time to let me talk, and then they shared their experience, they did that with me, and I was very lucky in that. And by the time I got home, it was 11:30 at night, almost every night. And I was too tired to drink. You know what I mean? I didn't want to drink, and I get up and I do it the next day. And my sobriety caught fire. You know, my relationships changed, and I did a 4-step when I was 18 months sober, and the morning I woke up to do my 5th step, I got a call of this guy who I started this business with. When I had gotten out, I had gotten cheated. I'm not a victim. I'm not telling you. Things had fallen apart between me and him, and things weren't the way we agreed when I got back out of prison. But I needed the job, and I needed to stay there because I didn't have very many options at that point. But what happened, so I had a huge resentment against this guy. The morning I got up to do my 5th step, I got a call, and his mom had passed away. Now, I'll tell you, I have absolutely never in my entire life had a resentment leave so quickly. Because at that point, I realized that nothing mattered except my friendship with him. It didn't matter about the money. It didn't matter about the business. That stuff doesn't matter when it comes down to friends and personal relationships and what you can do for somebody else. And I called him up, and I said, what do you need from me? What can I do for you? And he went down, and I ran the business while he was gone to take care of his mom. My life was great. You know, we ran around, and I was running around, and people in my home group were calling me the happy Hindu. And I was on fire in AA. And I'll tell you, I didn't have a whole lot going on. I had little money, beat up car. I mean, but I was happier than I was. You know, I was doing AA, and it was great. And at 3.5 years sober, it all came crashing down. I'm not going to be that dramatic. Life happened. The business failed. I had no money. My car was done. My mom was going blind in one eye. The girlfriend, the AA girlfriend that I thought now I was going to be with, left. And I didn't know what to do. The only thing I had was a roof over my head, and then I had AA, you know, and I was miserable. I mean, I was walking into AA meetings, people asking me how I'm doing, and I'd be like, I'm fine. And I literally had to leave after meetings because I couldn't talk to people. I ended up getting a job working at my friend's gas station, and there's no bad way to make a good living, and we're all God's kids, and he doesn't care what we do. It doesn't matter what our professions are, it doesn't matter. And, you know, I learned that lesson the hard way because I ended up working in this gas station, and I thought, and he asked me, he showed me what I had to do this one time, and when I got there, he showed me the bathroom, public restroom, and he said, you have to clean this every morning. I said, excuse me? Me? You want me to clean that bathroom? And he said, yeah, that's part of your job. And now, my ego had gotten so big in those, you know, 2.5 years that I had been in AA and everything was going great that I thought I was above that. What I failed to remember was 2.5 years before that in prison, I was cleaning bathrooms for free. Right. Lesson learned. The next day I was in that bathroom and I was in so much emotional pain, more than I've been in drunk or sober. And I was on my knees in that bathroom crying. And I was really happy I cleaned the bathroom. But I was praying to God, and I said, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? And my phone rang, and it was a member of AA. And ironically enough, it's a guy we call Crybaby. But he talked to me, you know, and that was the first time in the time I'd been sober that I wanted to drink, really. But he talked me out of it, and I got out of that bathroom, and that night a guy who I used to sponsor called me and asked me to sponsor him again. And I took him down to a 3,000-person AA conference 2 days later. I was miserable. I didn't want to be there. I hated everybody. But I was chairing a young people's committee at the time, and I had to be there for the dance, and I had to be there for that guy. I have come to believe that God does not care how I feel. He cares what I do. Because as long as I end up doing right, I will feel good eventually. And I don't get me wrong, I believe that God wants me to be happy. I believe he puts us here. He doesn't put us here to be miserable. He wants me to be happy, but there's going to be times when I'm not. And that during those times, it's a matter of what I do and the actions that I take that matter. And it's about staying the course in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because eventually, you know, feeling good is a direct byproduct of right living. And if I continue to live right, I'm going to feel good eventually. And that's what my experience. You know, that's the essence of the third step for me is. Well, let me tell you. After all this stuff happened, a couple months later, I got the job back, the girl back, and I got a new job. All this stuff was right again. In my mind. So I talked to my sponsor, and I'm like, look, how do I know where I'm putting my reliance? You know, everything was really bad, and I felt really bad, and now things are okay, and I feel okay. And he goes, well, what are you doing differently? And I said, nothing. He goes, and I said, I'm still going to meetings, I'm still sponsoring guys, I'm still talking to you, I'm still reading the book, I'm doing all the stuff that I usually did. And I did it when everything was bad, and I was doing it when everything was good. And he said, there you have it. I said, huh? What he's talking about, that's where my faith is. You know, that's the essence of the third step for me. As long as I continue to do this, it doesn't matter what the outcome is as long as I do the right thing. Right? As long as I take the right action, the outcome's going to be the outcome, and I can be okay with it. But if I'm doing the wrong thing, then I'm going to start being really upset about stuff, and I can't be accepting of it. And that's, for me, the essence of the third step. So I've been lucky in AA, and I've been blessed with a lot of things. And I've had the honor of chairing a couple of young people's committees. And one of them was the Maryland Gathering of Young People in AA. In 2007, we did it in August, and we had the committee, we had the conference, and we ended up, we weren't sure if we were going to break even, and it was, you know, all this stuff was going on, and we had trouble with the hotel. And my mom went to California to go see my sister at this time, and I got a call at 9 a.m. when the first meeting started on Saturday morning of the conference from California, which is 6 a.m. there. And I talked to my sister a couple times leading up to this day, and my mom wasn't doing so hot. There was something wrong. My sister called me and she was crying, and my mom was delirious and she couldn't talk and she didn't know who she was and she didn't know who I was. And it turned out my mom's kidneys had failed and her blood had poisoned her. And I have lived with my mom since I came home from prison, and I've been taking care of her and I've been paying the mortgage and doing all the things that I can and helping her. And at that point I realized, you know what, I'm 3,000 miles away and there's absolutely nothing I can do except believe in the God that I believe in and know that my mom's got a God too. So I told my sister to take her to the hospital and to take care of her and do all these things. And during that conference, it was, you know, I was getting news about if we were going to break even, and I'm getting news from my sister and all this stuff. And it's up and down and up and down. And it's the most emotional day of my life. And our area delegate came up to me and asked me what was wrong. And I told her. And she said, let me know what you need. I have two kidneys. I'll give you one if you need it. And most people would take that as just somebody saying something nice, trying to be nice. She actually emailed me, you know, after the conference and asked her where she wanted me to go where I wanted her to go for the blood test. My mom came out of her whatever it was, her delirium and all that stuff, and she was fine. And the first time I got to talk to her on the telephone in California, she asked me how I was doing, and we talked a little bit, and then she asked me how my sponsor was doing, and she asked me how my grand sponsor was doing, and she asked me how some of my pigeons were doing. My mom has peace of mind thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't pay back. I mean, I get a lot of stuff, but none of it matters compared to the peace of mind my mom's got. My mom came home, and I had to continue working and stuff, and you guys picked her up and took her to the doctor. You came home. I had a 7-time convicted felon. One of those convictions was for attempted murder. Brought my mom dinner and sat with her for 2 hours and talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what you guys do. I'm forever grateful for that kind of stuff. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. Back in January, I told you what happened about 3.5 years sober. So back in January, 2 days before Christmas, same thing, almost the exact same thing happened. The girl I had been in a long-term relationship left 2 days before Christmas. She started dating a dude with 90 days, 2 weeks later. I got laid off my job a little bit after that. My sister, who now I have an amazing relationship with, who I've fully amended everything with, left for Africa for 2 years. And then my mom was at a dialysis treatment and her blood pressure dropped to 94 over 30. And I'm going, God, what do you want? What are we doing? You know, why? What are we doing? We did this once already. I've got faith. I'm here. And I'm asking him what he wants me to do. And you know what? And three guys asked me to sponsor him in a week. Not what I was looking for, God. But you know what? I had time to spend with those guys. And two of them are still sober. And I was miserable. And I didn't... And I called these people, I called my friends with time in 20 years and 25 years, and I asked them, what do I do? What? And they were like, you know, let go and let God. And they were like, forgiveness isn't forgetting, you know, and letting go isn't giving up. I said, what? and they said, stay the course. And I did, and I have. And what's happened is, I ended up getting I got a better job 2 weeks after that. These guys asked me to sponsor them. I've got me and that girl are actually working things out, you know. And I'm not telling you this because I've got to give me a God job or get me a God job or a God that gives me a relationship or any of that stuff. What I'm saying is that I've stayed the course in Alcoholics Anonymous no matter what happens. And through that I've got an undeniable faith that God is there, and God is there for all of us. I believe that every single one of us is here because of God's grace. We get here because of God's grace. God doesn't all of a sudden say, okay, I'm done giving you my grace. What happens is we watch people, and it happens all the time, we stop putting ourselves in a position to receive that grace. We stop going to meetings. We stop talking to a sponsor. We stop helping another alcoholic. We stop doing our service commitments. One by one, little by little, we stop doing it, and then they're out the door, and you're not in a position to receive God's grace anymore. And that's what happens. And I think, you know, that's... I'm not special, and I'm not anything. I'm one of God's kids, and just like the rest of you, I have been blessed with a lot of things. You know, I've been the guy who got kicked out of school is now in grad school getting straight A's, but I'm that same. You know, and I've got a job where people respect me. I was sitting in a room with the CEO, and the chairman of the board, and the chief operating officer of my firm. Oh, I worked for a law firm. And this is my third one. They did a background check at the first one I was going to, and they asked me in this interview. I interviewed with 9 people. They said, this is a drug-free workplace. How can you sure it's going to stay that way? I said, well, I haven't had a drink or a drug in 3.5 years, and I don't plan to ever again. And they said, thank you, and continued the interview, and they called me back and gave me the job 20 minutes later. I didn't know it was a law firm when I applied, obviously. But here's the kicker. 6 months after I started that job, 3 years ago, we moved into a building that was directly across the street from the building that I worked in when I got arrested. I was doing almost the exact same thing, making almost the exact same money, in almost the exact same place, but I was a completely different person. I don't know how you get from where I was that day to where I came without a God. And it's all due to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm me. If without you, I'm a lying, cheating, stealing, drug-dealing alcoholic. And now today, on most days, I can just say I'm an alcoholic. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, please stay. If you've gone in and out, stay. find what you were doing wrong and find the people that are doing it right and stay. You know, and if you're here and you're miserable and you've been here for a while, find somebody that's not and do what it says in this book, because it says rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Rarely means almost never. It doesn't say 1 in 10, it doesn't say 1 in 4, it says almost, it's everyone. If you do what we do, you're going to get what we get. And that's what it's promising here. And that's the closest thing to a guarantee you're going to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe we're all here because someone prayed, whether it's mother, brother, sister, father, girlfriend, whatever, you know. And we get an opportunity to live blessed lives. And I thank you for my life, and I thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for letting me share.